Welcome to the Riverside Project podcast. We are mobilizing Houston to empower families and transform generations. We hope these conversations will give you a greater understanding of the issues facing our community and inspire you to find your place along the river. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Riverside Project podcast. Today, I am so excited to introduce to you Isaac Etter. Isaac is an adoptee and social entrepreneur who was transracially adopted at the age of 2. He founded Identity, a startup focused on helping adoptive and foster families to thrive. At Identity, Isaac is working on reimagining post-placement support for adoptive and foster families. He uses his story and his deep passion for adoption and foster care education to bring relevant, quality, and diverse resources to adoptive and foster parents. Isaac, thank you so much for being here. We're so grateful for your voice, and I'm really excited to share a little bit of your story and just your expertise and experience with our listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. I think this is going to be a great time.
Great. Well, let's just start off as we always do. Tell me a little bit about who you are and what your story is. And I'm excited about this conversation.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I'm Isaac, as you said, and I'm an adoptee, you know, kind of first and foremost, I guess. I was adopted when I was 2. I was with my birth mother up until then, so I didn't spend too much time in the foster care system, only about a month. So I was placed for adoption and adopted fairly quickly. And then I was adopted transracially, so my parents are white and I'm black. And so growing up, I experienced a lot of feeling like the only one, a lot of feeling very alone and isolated. Though my parents are great and very loving, what they didn't do well was surround me in communities that represented me, that looked like me. So for a lot of my life, I felt very, you know, alone, kind of like, it's kind of on the nose, but kind of like the black sheep, as you might say. And so, you know, it was a long time, you know, really up until I was an adult and was going to college, to where I had friends that were black that came from black homes. So growing up, the only people that I were around that looked like me or close to me were also adopted. And so though that was wonderful to have friends that were adopted, we were all having the same confusion, right? None of us were ahead of the other.
Yeah.
And so we were all having the same challenges. And so after a couple years, you know, after going to college and starting to bring these issues up, it was very tough for my family to understand me at first. And so one of the hardest parts of my journey with my family was been trying to bring up kind of some of the pain around growing up in a community that didn't represent me and going out into a world that I wasn't prepared for, right? So like I wasn't prepared to experience racism in college because I'd never been around white people that didn't know my family was white. And so there were things that I ran into as an adult that were very hard for me and very hard for me to understand. And my parents also just couldn't understand at first. And so after a pretty tense kind of year and a half, 2 years, my family and me slowly started to kind of work through things. They found mentorships. They read. I learned how to communicate even better. I'm sure I wasn't the best communicator at 18.
who is, right?
And yeah, exactly. And eventually we were able to get on a page where I felt like they understood where I was coming from. They understood the experience that I was having. And they understand also the areas in which they didn't set me up for success. Right. And
sure.
So their acknowledgement of that, and my acknowledgement that they are loving parents, right. They didn't do that in a malicious way. Definitely led to a pretty good reunion between us and a really good way for us to kind of move forward. You know, even though that was happening in the background, it wasn't like a public thing at first. It wasn't like a known thing. I was already doing like kind of community advocacy work in Lancaster. Mm-hmm. I was back home at this point. An adoption agency that I crossed paths with asked me to come to a cultural training of theirs. So I'd gone through this whole thing with my family, right? I'd had the upbringing. I'd had the whole kind of like year and a half, 2 years of kind of like this tension and complicated relationship with my family that was finally starting to resolve. And just as life does, an adoption agency found me and asked me to just volunteer and come to their cultural training and to share my story. And so after, you know, a couple months of doing that, the social worker, you know, she just kind of pulled me aside and she was like, I'm not really sure what else you're doing, but you should probably just do this. And I hadn't really thought of it like that before. You know, this was just something that I was kind of volunteer doing and definitely something that I liked to do. I mean, it was evident that people were getting a lot out of it. But after that moment, I was young and I didn't necessarily know where I was going. And so I decided to just go all in on it. And that was 2019. And since then, I've gotten to speak, you know, just pretty much around the country on this issue. And, you know, back then I was really just like a speaker and a consultant. And when I was doing that, I learned a lot about the kind of unique challenges that were happening, not just in Lancaster or Pennsylvania, where I'm from, but everywhere. You know, it's kind of strange, but the same issues that my family had or the same issues I'm seeing on the other side of the country. And so really figuring out that a lot of these issues are universal. And a lot of times parents are not naive. They're just confused on the next steps. So they may understand that they need to do something, but not understand what it is, or there might be awkwardness and tension around doing it. And so in 2021, I decided to start Identity. And shifted my gear from just like speaking, but how do we actually create these resources that families can use, that they can refer back to? And how do we do it in multiple ways? You know, there's a lot of people who like to read, but there's also people who like to watch, and there's also people who like hands-on stuff. And so we started with our practical guides, you know, and a practical guide to transracial adoption, which is the one that I wrote. Is used very frequently by agencies and families, but we also have one on Black hair care, and in May we'll have one on adoption after infertility, kind of bridging that gap for families who are transitioning journeys. And so, you know, our goal is to not only have the kind of like that physical, tangible resource, but also to add a content layer so that those kind of visual and audio learners can also get something out of it. And so we have a podcast with me and my mom called Inside Transracial Adoption, where we walk through our journey. Yeah, thank you.
I've liked it. Yeah, it's been really very helpful and insightful.
Thank you. I love doing that with my mom. It's very nice. And then we also have a docuseries on me and my family's journey. And so we try to, like, you know, we're going to do the same thing with hair care this summer, you know, add a bunch of visual components, add a bunch of YouTube trainings. We're going to do the same thing with the infertility guide and some of our other upcoming guides, where we add like this podcast and visual layer to it. Because again, a lot of times parents know what they need to do, but the action of it can be very intimidating, scary, or unknown. And so we want to create a lot of ways for families, one, to learn, but also to see how it can actively be done. And so that's kind of a wraparound of my story and how I got here. And just like a lot of the things that I think of, I mean, those are the things I think about on a daily level, on a daily basis, which is like, how do we take some of this information that we know families need, make it really accessible and tangible, and not through just one medium mode, right? How do we make it accessible across multiple kinds of platforms and learning?
Yeah, that's so great and so necessary. I think you using your voice in that way and recognizing, you know, taking your experience from your college experience, it sounds like, and then being able to look back at your childhood and say, oh, there are actually gaps here that I didn't even really recognize until I was older. And how can I be a voice of change so that other adoptive or adoptees don't have that same struggle, or maybe they have the same struggle, but they have resources to be able to help them through that experience. Yeah. At what point, I assume, you looking back, it's much easier to see in your upbringing that there were things that were missing, but you probably didn't recognize it, I would expect, in the moment. When was that moment that shifted for you, that something was missing and you felt ill-equipped to move into adulthood without some of these skills? When was that? And then were there specific things that started that trajectory for you?
Yeah. So one of the first things that came up for me was actually like learning things from the internet. So, you know, I was in high school, kind of during the beginning of Black Lives Matter. And so the internet taught me a lot of things that I had never learned. You know, my senior year of high school, I was online and coming across hashtags and seeing all kinds of things and learning all kinds of things that nobody ever mentioned to me. You know, my like legitimate education on racism and civil rights issues was like Martin Luther King Jr. and like Rosa Parks. So from my perspective, as you know, I was a homeschooled, you know, black kid in a small town that's known for Amish people. so like, you know what I mean? There wasn't like a lot of things around that would have cued me into it. And so really the internet is what really started making me think that I might have a different experience, but it was also confusing because I didn't have any context for it. Yeah. But the night I turned 17, me and my friends were kind of on a walk late at night, you know, just because we're in like a rural area. And I was coming, we were walking back to my parents' house, coming kind of down this long, kind of long hill, road hill kind of thing. And at the end of the road, there was a cop car that was flashing around a light like it was looking for somebody. And so me and my friend started running back to my parents' house. And while we were running, one of my friends shouted out, "It's all right. Isaac's the only one that's going to get in trouble." And I remember that for me, that was when it all kind of came together. Because, you know, we were all 16, 17, 18. You know, we were all young. And I knew that if I was just learning about this, if I was like just starting to figure this out, but they were already like, they already knew this, then it was information that like was known. I was just the only one that wasn't told or didn't know. And so that's when the shift happened, where I really realized, okay, like I'm probably walking out into something that I don't understand. And then in college, you know, kind of the rubber immediately met the road.
Yeah. What was your experience in college like?
Yeah. So in college, you know, I went to a very small private college, and it was probably a mistake to go to such a small school in my hometown. But really one of the hardest parts about going to college for me, because there was like some blatant things that happened, and there was, you know, awkward situations with teachers where I'd get asked to speak on like black issues, like Colin Kaepernick kneeling or anything else that was in the news. But one of the hardest parts for me was the fact that I'd grown up in a community, pretty much all white people. I had mostly white friends my whole life. You know what I mean? Other than my adopted friends, who I was close with growing up. But I mean, most of my friends were white. So I was very comfortable. I didn't see anything weird about that. But in college, I noticed like immediate hesitation towards me, right? Lack of comfortability around me. You know,
from
people wondering,
from white friends or just,
yeah,
black
from just
friends
other, from students.
Or any,
yeah,
students?
Just from, yeah, other students. Yeah. You know, just in people like I was meeting, like for me to walk into a new school of 90% white people, it wasn't a phase for me. Like it was just a normal life thing for me. So I was comfortable like going and meeting people and trying to make friends, but I noticed immediately the hesitation, the odd looks, people wondering, you know, maybe why I was sitting with them. And then I also noticed the kind of like guard go down when they figured out I was adopted, or when it came up that I was adopted, or I brought up that I was adopted. And so it was one of those things that started to become very noticeable for me, like, oh, white people are only comfortable with me when they understand that I'm adopted. And that became a really hard issue for me, because I was like, oh man, that's weird, because this is like, to me, this is just the community I grew up in. So it's like not, to me, I don't need the context of like you having a white parents, you know what I mean? Or anything, you know what I mean? So that was probably the hardest part of that transition for me, was just realizing that without my parents, I wasn't super accepted by a lot of people in the white community, at least where I was going to school.
Yeah, I could imagine that being just such a strange feeling to recognize that my whole life I've been, you know, surrounded by this white family and they're attached to me. And so that gives a lens through which people see me. And so you don't even, it almost like shields you from some things. And then that shield is kind of gone. I don't know if shield is the right word, but that extra filter or lens through which you are seen is no longer there. The thought of, you know, I have two sons who are African American, and another son and daughter who are white. And so I think about that when they go to college, right? I feel the looks, you know, we've had the moments. Mm-hmm. Everybody, I think every transracial adoptive family feels, especially when it's new, there's things that are said, you know, things happen. People say silly things. Or there are certain moments and in different places where you feel like you're being looked at a certain way, not in necessarily in a bad way, just an intrigue. People are just intrigued by like, what's the story there? But the thought of my kids going to school or going somewhere without me, and their whole lens and their whole world has shifted because no longer am I, you know, for whatever I represent in that space, that's no longer there. And what that does to how they feel, I really applaud you just for recognizing that shift. I think it would probably be easy to just go along and say, this feels strange. I don't know what it is, but I'm just going to keep moving on.
Exactly.
But the insight to be able to recognize something is different here and I don't know what it is. And, I actually think it's because this lens is no longer there. And now I have to do this on my own. That's the thing that scares me the most too, with my kids, is like, they have to go out and live their life on their own. And it's a world that I don't always know how to equip them for. And I think that's what you now are doing for families. You're helping them, parents, to be able to equip their kids to be successful in the world. I'd love to say that the race thing doesn't matter, or that we can all get along and it's going to be fine and hunky-dory and we're going to be great. That's just not the reality for our family. And so I love being able to speak to you about this so that I can, and then the people that listen to us, who I know are in the same situation, they can get some tools and they can hear from someone who's actually walked that road. What can we do? One of the things that you've said is that your goal is to really prepare parents to equip their kids to live in a world where they are seen, heard, and valued. Can you share a little bit more about what does that mean? What is that goal for you? And then how do you make that happen? What's the practical steps to making your kids feel seen, heard, and valued? That's TBRI talk, right? The trauma-informed lens is to make sure that they feel seen, heard, and valued. And I think we do that so well in some ways. But that additional race factor sometimes gets missed. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, what it means to, you know, have children, especially adopted and foster children, feel seen, heard, and valued is, first off, to be seen, they have to be recognized for their whole experience. And I think a lot of times, because I think when you adopt, you want it to feel normal or regular or not weird, we try to disregard things or ignore things. And so when I say seen, adopted children need to feel like they're recognized for being adopted and that that's a part of their experience, right? It doesn't have to be like plastered over everything or talked about every minute of every day. But they also need to feel like, you know, they're not only seen through the lens of being your adopted child, like they do have this history, this connection, and they need to be able to feel like they are also seen for that. And then also we might want to take some context here for like interracial adoption, right? So with interracial adoption, they also have to be seen as people of a different race. So you have to recognize that factor as well, and parent accordingly. To feel heard, I think adoptees need to be able to voice pain and discomfort, right? So if you're making them feel seen and recognizing that they are adopted and there may be grief, challenges, confusion, especially in identity around that, you're also giving them a chance to feel heard in it, right? So you're not shutting down conversations about birth family or about adoption or trying to glance over it. You're actually creating the spaces for your children to actually have confusing and difficult feelings around being adopted. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, I think if you do both those things, children feel valued, right? They don't feel just valued as long as they exist in the context of your adopted child. They feel valued for their whole experience, right? Because their experience, regardless of when you adopted, they did have an experience and a connection before you, right? So they grew in a womb somewhere. And so that is a part of them. And even if you left the hospital with them, that's still a part of their journey. Mm-hmm. And so how do you make them feel seen for that, make them feel heard and allowed to voice those complications? I think when you do those things, children feel like, okay, like it's not, you don't just love me in the context of the fact that you got to adopt me and now erase my history. Like, no, you love me, the person that I am encompassing fully. Because those pieces of your child are there. And so I think it's really powerful when adoptive parents make space for their children to be that person, to experience all those things, to feel all the feelings that I think come with being adopted.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Are there things that you can look back on with your family, ways that you feel like your parents did that really well and allowed that space? And then maybe just one or two, or are there some of the areas where you felt like they could have done a better job, or, you know, every parent struggles in different ways. And so I'm not asking you to throw your parents under the bus. I'm sure you guys have walked through some tense conversations, but I think it's helpful for us to know, what are the ways that you feel like they did a really great job at that? And then what are some ways that you wish that they had done it differently?
Absolutely. So there's a couple of ways that I think they did it really great. One that was that adoption was never kind of like off the table to talk about. One thing that my parents did really well was that adoption, we could always talk about the adoption component. And so I always felt like, okay, like at least I, you know, get to voice this, because I had a lot of trouble and a lot of emotions around that growing up. You know, a couple areas where I think that they could have improved are definitely in like recognizing that I would have a different experience as a person of color, right? So that, like, that's a big one. I think that whether it was fully just them believing that it wouldn't happen or that it couldn't happen, or whether it was just not knowing what to do, there just was a lack of preparation for that experience for me. Another thing I think is, I think we talked about adoption, but I think there was a lot of signs that I was having difficulty with attachment and like kind of trauma responses to it. And so even though I got to be upset or be sad or feel complicated about being adopted, there wasn't necessarily a ton of like proactiveness in the direction of like the resolve. So it was just like a lot of like just being able to voice it, which is great, right? It's like definitely better than some people have. But I think there is kind of I think I showed a lot of signs very early that would have been signs for whether it be therapy or something like that. And so I think that your children, if you're creating the space for them to voice things, will cue you into how they're feeling, right?
Yeah.
And if your child is struggling very like heavily with like rejection feelings, abandonment feelings very early, that's going to show up in like attachment styles and different areas. Where they're going to need support and help earlier on.
Yeah,
I think making space is one of the best things and one of the things I actually see the least. So, you know, I feel blessed to have parents that made space for me to talk about adoption. But when I talk to older adoptees, one of the things I hear the least is that space was being made. Maybe it was always known and like adoption days happen and like all the things, like it wasn't that adoption was a secret or something you never talked about. But the real space to feel complicated or grieve or pain around adoption wasn't there. And so they often felt like, hey, like, I'm happy that I was adopted. I'm like, I love my parents. Like, there's nothing wrong with my parents. But I always felt like I could never express the pain that I was feeling to them. And ultimately, that's a bond that I think parents want to have with their children. You don't want your children to, like, grow up and basically feel like they can't come to you about such a big part of their life. Like you want to be a part of that process for them and a part of that healing for them as well.
Yeah. I think there's the making the space, allowing them to voice those things and then doing something with that, whatever is said, is what you're saying, is there's an added component that it's really, really helpful to give them the space to share those things. And then when they do, yes, be with them. Yes, comfort them, but also take some steps towards meeting those needs that they're sharing. And I think that might be the point at which many of us, including myself, don't really know where to turn. I remember my oldest adopted son around the age of 4 started saying, I don't want to have brown skin. I want to have white skin like you. I don't, you know, people with brown skin are bad. I don't know where that even came from, but it really stems from a lack of people in his life who he's seen, who he's been around. And so those things, like, yes, we made space to tell me what you feel about those things. We made lots of space for him to express those things. We've, you know, helped with trauma therapies and given him some tools, but there still is this gap of giving him what he's needing. And that's been a struggle for us. You know, we live in a part of town that does not have a whole lot of diversity. We're a part of a church that doesn't have a ton of diversity. They go to a school. We attempted to switch his school to a more diverse school. And unfortunately, that didn't work out super well just because of some academic things and some learning challenges. But we're trying to take those steps, but it's in those practical, we make space, we listen, we come near. But then in those moments, there's specific things and needs that are being expressed in a way that a 4 or 5 or 6 year old can. And it's what do we do with those things that where I think a lot of us get tripped up, or at least I can say that for myself. What do you think, where do we turn at that point?
Yeah. So like if you've done everything, you've gone down the socials list and you've tried to switch schools and all of that, I think one of the best things you can do at that point is, well, let me say it like this. I'd say that if you can't win on the school front, you know what I mean, then look for extracurriculars. So one thing that I've heard that's worked really well for people is church. So if you go to church, if you go to any kind of religious, you know, community event on Sundays or the weekend, Saturdays, switching those things, if you can, I think is always one of the best things that you can do. Extracurriculars outside of school. So what kind of sports, what kind of extracurricular activities? You know, there's even that scene in This Is Us where he goes to like the black karate dojo, right, with his son. And so think about things like that, right? I think that's like next step if you can't figure out schooling. But then I'd also try to look in your town and in your like region, you know, however much you'd be willing to drive, you know, like an hour or 2 hours, and see what kind of like festivals and events are happening, right? So like if there's an African-American festival, like there's one that happens here in Lancaster, you know, I learned about when I was an adult. And so it's like, can you go to that yearly? What other kind of events are happening? Like a lot of NAACPs in different towns do events for adults, but they also do events for kids. So they do like book readings and they do Black History Month events. And so like libraries are another good one actually too. Libraries tend to do a lot of events like that as well. So like what can you find in your area that makes sense, that's easily accessible and like may also engage your child's interest already? So if you have a kid that's interested in like sports, like there's a lot of sports things that you can put them in that would have diverse communities. If they're interested in like, you know, science, math, learning, you know, just like kind of also gauge some of their interest and see like, okay, how can I have them kind of live out that passion, but in a setting where they would see other kids like them? Because it would be pretty hard, right, to like be like a kid who's has an exceptional skill, whatever it may be, math, writing, sports. But just to be like the only person of that race or color there might be a little bit isolating. And so like also letting their passions be surrounded by other kids that are just like them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just meeting them where they are in that and then doing, you're not going to do it perfectly. I'm not going to do it perfectly. Nope. We're not going to, you know, figure all of it out or reverse some of the things that of their story that you wish were different and their pain. Yeah. But I think if nothing else, it communicates that I prioritize this for you because this matters.
Yeah.
And I want to be able to do my best to make sure that you have what you need. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think prioritizing, letting them see themselves in their interest areas, right? So like one thing that I felt growing up was that like none of my interests did I ever see like a representation that looked like, right? So it can mean a lot even just to have your kids be in spaces where like the person that they want to be also looks like them, right? So they're getting this visual representation of what their life could be. So it's not even just about like, are there Black people in the room? But like, is this person a good representation of who my child may become in the future, right?
Yeah.
And so like, I would have loved to see, you know, Black teachers, you know, Black professionals. I was interested in like lighting and sound design when I was in high school. And so like, it would have been great to be around other Black professionals who had like theater tech careers, right? Mm-hmm. And so like, how do you also make it like really tangible for your child? So that it's not just like, you're kind of like checking the box, right? You don't just want to go to the festival to go to the festival and then leave, right? And then you kind of did your yearly event. It's like, how can you make some of these things really work for your family and to your child's advantage? And fill like those gaps, right? It's hard to be a kid, especially if you have siblings that are biological who all, you know, have that visual representation growing up of what they're going to look like as adults. So finding creative ways to give your child community where they can see adult versions of themselves and see what their future could look like, I think is really helpful.
Yeah, I think the last time when we met briefly, you mentioned mirrors. And it's, I never heard it as a specific term. And I don't know that we actually had a conversation about it. But I remember saying at some point, I think it was just to my husband, like, it's, I don't like that what my kid, what our kids see in the world doesn't always match what they see in the mirror. And that just thinking about how difficult that, or what that might feel like to someone, because when I look at my upbringing and I look at the way I grew up, it was something I never even considered because it just was. But how shifty the ground would feel if what I always see out of my eyes does not always match what I see in the mirror. Will that change what the way I feel about what I see in the mirror? Will it change the way I feel about what, how I see the world? But getting curious about those things and then really trying to see it from their perspective, I think opens our eyes a little bit to the world that they see, and the way that they see their themselves. It's burdening to me a little. I mean, it really does burden my heart a bit, because I do think that that is so important. And when I think about when I grew up, the heroes, you know, I was a gymnast. And so like the heroes that I had just in that world, you look for those types of people that represent you and that helps you to see who you could be in the world one day. And so anyway, share a little bit more about the what you mean by mirrors and how that's helpful for children.
Absolutely. Yeah. So mirrors is just like a representation of yourself, right? So like a lot of people don't even think about mirrors because they grow up around like their parents and like people who look like them, like family that look like them. But especially in the case of like transracial adoption, and you know, this can even happen in like same race adoptions, I think too, but you're not growing around people that are visual representations of you. And so there can be confusion and lack of understanding of like what you might look like as an adult, what features are from where. And so giving especially transracially adopted children racial mirrors allows them to visualize older versions of themselves, and also have it like not come from necessarily like media, right? So like we could, like growing up, like one of the only examples I can give you is like Little Bill and Fresh Prince of like my examples of like what I understood about Black people that look like me. And like, they're not like super wrong visuals, but they're not like the best only visuals to have, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it makes a difference when your kid gets to go to like, you know, it doesn't always happen, but like having a Black teacher would be great, right? So then you have this visual representation, somebody that looks like you that's doing a great, you know, a teaching job. Maybe your kid wants to be a teacher one day, and now they can kind of like have this straight line and be like, okay, I'll be like Mr. Smith here. And so what I think it does is it lessens the isolation feeling of transracial adoption. You're not the only one anymore because you're surrounded by these different adults and children who all look like you, may also have different families, right? So you may go to a school where a kid has two moms or two dads, or another kid is adopted, or, you know, co-parenting situation. So like you kind of also can break up some of like this, you know, families only look one way type of thing. Cause I think when kids get their visuals, and media has changed a little bit, but a lot of times when kids get their ideas of family from like media, it looks like very one way. And so then the isolation feeling only continues. So it's like, okay, it's nice that Little Bill was a Black character, but he had a Black mom and dad. So now it's like, it's still like you're still in that kind of bubble, right? And so I think it's kind of nice when you have communities that all like have different representations, because your kid can also see themselves, but also see that family can also look a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And that can be confusing for kids too. Like that family can look different ways.
Yeah. I think in the past there, and sometimes still today, there's this idea also around adoption that if we just love our kids enough, then that's going to overcome their challenges with trauma or, you know, their racial struggles. And I think that it is shifting away from that a little bit. Love is great. And love is 100% a part of, like, we're not throwing that out. Love is very, very helpful, and it is a component. But do you ever encounter families who still struggle to believe that this type of work is needed? And how do we respond to that? How do we get that information to them and or convince them that, hey, this is an important issue?
Yeah. So I think I like to give this example. It's very similar to me as like marriage, which is like, nobody who's been married or been in like a long-term relationship will tell you that love is enough. Like, it's just like, nobody's going to tell you that. Right. Like, they'd be dumb to tell you that too. Right. Cause you know that a lot of things happen, you know, people annoy you, you have fights, things, you have to work at loving a partner. And I would actually argue that if you have biological kids, people would not tell you that love is enough. They would tell you that you have to work pretty hard to love them sometimes. And so I think it's just like a really big kind of, I don't know, you might say like outdated or just like wrong, like kind of marketing message that got sent through adoption historically. Mm-hmm. And I think, it was probably meant to encourage people to adopt and get away from bad stigmas of adoption or maybe adoption from foster care stigmas. So the intention might have been positive when it started, but for people who that's their introduction to adoption or believe that or think that, it tends to kind of hit them in the face at one point or another because kids are kids, like biological or not. At some point or another, that kid's going to be pretty difficult to love, whether it's when they've just destroyed the room you just cleaned or, you know, they're having reactions to trauma that lives inside their body. Right. And so I think that love, one, is just a part of like committing to somebody. Like when you go to adopt, you're committing to that person just like marriage, right? Mm-hmm. So love is something that I think is a part of adoption or should be regardless, right? You shouldn't adopt if you don't want to love the child. but it is not enough because your child is, one, going to have their own experience. So they're going to have their own complexities, their own journey. And that may lead them to do and have reactions to things that are going to be hard, right? Like we see there's a lot of statistics about mental health challenges with adoptees and foster kids. There's even, you know, statistics about some of those kids ending up in like juvie type situations. So like, I think the idea of love is enough sends a misconception because like, what do you do when those challenges come up? What do you do when the behavioral challenges come up or the hard times, or maybe that there's stories of adopted kids who like have a year or two where they hate their adoptive parents. And that's not actually true. They don't actually hate their adoptive parents. They just are confused about this idea of adoption. They're struggling with the abandonment, right? So is love enough then? You know what I mean? Like, if you're not getting it back. And so I think that it's not, is love enough or love is enough? It's a commitment. It's a commitment to making your children feel seen. It's a commitment to make your children feel heard, and ultimately making them feel valued. It's a commitment to daily stepping into, not like a battle zone, but like you're stepping into an arena every day where you're recognizing that there is loss involved. There is trauma involved to some degree or another. And you're stepping into that arena every day knowing that it could show up in a million different ways, right?
Yeah.
It could show up very positively as like an overachiever student who never wants to do wrong and freaks out anytime they do anything wrong. Or it can show up as in a child who doesn't want to do anything well and wants to destroy everything in their path. But the love should be the underlying commitment, right? It's not the thing. It's just a part of the thing. It's a part of parenting. It's a part of getting through the highs and the lows. And you have to be committed to both of those journeys with love as kind of like just this underlying thing. Like you're committing to love this person when it's good, when it's bad, and knowing that the love isn't going to fix the issue. the love is just helping you keep mm-hmm. through the journey.
Yeah, I think it's the root, right? It's not that we throw that part out. It's just, it has to be a love that's not a love in and of itself. It is a love that motivates us to commit to one another. It's a love that motivates us to sacrifice for one another, even if that means I'm going to step into a world that I don't have any idea about, or I don't even feel necessarily comfortable, but I'm going to step into the discomfort because you live in a world of discomfort. I'm going to step into the uncertainty because you live in a world of uncertainty. So it's not that the love is not there. It's just, it can't stop with just feelings of love or this idea of love, but an actual motivated and tangible, lived out sacrificial love. Right.
Absolutely.
Maybe that's the difference.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Is there anything else to, if you were talking to parents who are just stepping into the journey of, hey, we're going to become foster parents, we're going to adopt, and we may adopt a child that looks like us, and we're open to adopting a child that doesn't. What do you think would be helpful on the front end that they could be doing to prepare so that this is the lens through which they're walking with from the very beginning? Are there any things that people can do or to consider at that point?
Yeah. I think you have to consider whether the conversations and the sacrifices that it does take to raise adopted kids are what you want to do, right? And so if you're adopting a child of a different race, so transracially, you have to ask yourself very genuinely, are those commitments that you want to make, that for 18 years you want to make commitments to being in those communities and ideally longer, right? And so is that a commitment that you actually want to make? And like, there's no right or wrong answer. You haven't adopted a child yet. So like, if you don't want to, you then know that that may not be for you. And then I think just in adoption in general, and especially like foster care, you have to just understand that like there's loss and there's grief and there's things involved that are going to show up. Like I have adopted friends who like growing up, adoption wasn't an issue, but as adults, it's like really hard for them. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like, understand that like grief and loss that comes with adoption, it can show up differently in different seasons of life. And so are you willing to sit in that when your child is six and when they're 26 or 30? And so like just asking yourself like those questions, I think are just really good. I think that those are the things you need to think about before adopting, because loss and grief are part of adoption regardless. Like those are going to happen regardless. They're part of foster care in a lot of ways too. A lot of foster children, especially depending on their age, may not even understand why they're not with their parents, right? So there's going to be all kinds of things that show up. And so I think you have to be committed to standing in that gap and being there for your child in a different way than you may been raised or seen. But it can also be very powerful and very beautiful when you do that.
Yeah, that's good. Is there anything else that you want to share just kind of as we close up our time? Anything else that you would want to share? And then how can families or organizations engage more with your work? You mentioned your study guides and some of the things that are coming out, but how can we best continue to engage with you and learn from your experience?
Absolutely. So you can go to isaacetter.com or identitylearning.co, C-O. And then on Instagram, it's going to be identity.learning. And on YouTube, it's also identity.learning. So there's a lot of fun stuff on the internet that you can engage with me. I try to keep it fun and keep it engaging. And so I'd love for people to go and engage with that stuff. If you want to learn more about my story, there's a way to do that. But then you can also find any of our practical guides, one on transracial adoption and one on Black hair care are currently out. But then you can also pre-order our practical guide to adoption after infertility starting in about a week. And so that will cover if you're a family that's, been trying to conceive for years, months, however long, and you're ready to make an adoption plan now. I think there's a lot of things that from that journey to adopting kind of get mashed together. So we partnered with Dr. Anna Coley, who's gone through this experience herself and has done a ton of research and trainings around this to create really, I think, a really good workbook for parents who are ready to pursue adoption after going through that. But we know there's still grief and loss a part of that journey. So like, how do you navigate that into this one?
That's so good.
Really excited about it. I think it's going to be very powerful. And I think it only helps like continue our mission of creating a world where children feel seen, heard, and valued. Because whether it's intentional, like it's always, I think it's unintentional, but a lot of times when our goal is to have a child, we can get all kinds of things confused in there. Mm-hmm. And one example that I'll give that she gives that I think is really helpful is that some people don't know whether they want to have a child or whether they want to carry a baby, like have a baby in their womb. And if you don't know which one of those you are, then you could be going to adopt, trying to resolve or solve an issue that is not going to be resolved or solved, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's actually really, I think, important step for parents to consider as they navigate that transition. And I think it only helps children who are going into those homes to have parents who have walked through some of those questions. I'm excited about it. And I think it's going to be powerful and helpful.
It sounds like it's going to be a future podcast episode. So
yeah. Tune in. I'll get you in contact with her. She'll be great.
I think that would be real. It's a very, very important conversation and one that we come across quite a bit. And one that there's not a lot of resources or voices out there from a lived experience. So stay tuned for that one.
Absolutely.
The last 5 minutes of our time, I typically go into just a few kind of rapid fire questions just to get, you know, let us know a little bit more about who is Isaac Etter. So let's roll through those real quick before we sign off. Okay. Number one, if you could pick a TV show, old or current, to live in, which one would you pick?
Oh man, that's a great question. Growing up, I really loved that show Suits, and I know it made an appearance on Netflix again. So I think I would go there for now.
I love that you said when you were growing up. That just shows how much younger you are. Definitely not a show when I was growing up, but more so like it feels like a few years ago.
I was in high school when it came out.
Goodness gracious. It's a great show, though. I really did like it.
It is, yes.
Okay, number two, salty or sweet?
Ooh, probably sweet.
Or are you one of those people that mixes the two, like popcorn and candy?
I do like to mix it a lot, but usually I like to have like a savory meal and then like a sweet dessert. And okay, so it's like technically both, but I definitely would go more towards the sweets if I had to choose.
Okay, that's good. Introvert or extrovert?
I'm actually oddly introverted, and I think it kind of grew on me as I got older and had to do more public like things like speaking and things like that. Sure. But I'm for the most part very introverted.
Yeah. I could see that. I mean, sometimes the people who, just because you speak and, you know, you're out there in the world doing things with people doesn't mean that you're not a more introverted kind of energy person.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Number four, what's your favorite cereal?
Ooh, great question. I like the Captain Crunch berries. I haven't had it in a long time. But that has historically been a favorite, and I'll probably be thinking about it. I know I shouldn't eat it, but that has historically been a favorite, or the Reese's Puffs.
Okay. Yeah. Both favorites of my kids. The more sugar in the cereal, the better.
That's how I grew up too.
Cocoa exactly. Puffs and Cinnamon Toast Crunch were my go-tos as kids. And I don't know how I didn't have diabetes by the time I was 16 or something.
Those are good ones though. I like those ones too.
All right, last one. If you could have dinner with anyone dead or alive, who would it be?
Oh, it would be Steve Jobs, who is also an adoptee. And so actually a big part of why I love his stuff and read a lot of his stuff is because one of the reasons that he was such a great entrepreneur is because he was adopted. And he talks in basically all of his biographies, he talks very much about how adoption affected his self-worth and basically made him such a hard worker and so hard on people and himself. And he's not obviously a perfect character, but his journey is very, like, I understand it very well. And so I would love to have an adoption talk with Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
I'm probably one of the only people who would talk about adoption, not tech.
But not all the other things that he's accomplished.
I know. I mean, some of those too, but I would love to just have an adoptee chat with Steve Jobs and just get inside that part of his life.
Yeah. There's so many fascinating people. I'm always drawn to different podcasts or stories about famous people and how they ended up doing what they did, or very accomplished people, inventors, and what motivate, because it didn't just happen, right? It didn't.
Right.
For most people, there's a story behind it, and it's always so intriguing, but we don't always know all of those parts. So yeah, that's a that's a great one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Isaac. It is a pleasure to spend some time with you. And I know this isn't going to be the last conversation that we have. I'm just really thrilled about the voice that you have in this space. And I'm excited about getting more people able to hear it and connected with you. So thank you so much again for all that you do and all that you're working through. We really appreciate your time.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
To those listening, we hope these conversations have inspired you to find your place along the river. And we welcome you to join us in bringing hope and renewal to the city of Houston. If you'd like more information on how to get involved, please visit riversideproject.org and submit a contact form. We'll see you next time.